This is Audible.
Audio Sorceress presents the unabridged recording of Pen Pal, written by J.T. Geisinger, narrated by Tara Langella and Troy Duran.
One. Inferno. The path to paradise begins in hell. The Divine Comedy. One. It's raining as my husband's casket is lowered into the hole in the ground, raining hard, as if the sky itself is about to rip in half like my heart has. I stand motionless under an umbrella, but the other mourners, listening to the priest drone on about resurrection and glory, blessings and suffering, redemption and the holy love of God, so many words and all so meaningless. Everything is meaningless. There's a Michael-shaped hole in my chest and nothing matters anymore. That must be why I feel so numb. I'm empty. Grief has blown me apart, scattering my bones into a desert wasteland where they'll bake in silence under a merciless sun for 1,000 years. A woman behind me quietly weeps into her handkerchief. Sharon, Karen, a colleague of Michael's who I met at a long-ago faculty party. One of those awful holiday work parties in a school auditorium where they serve cheap wine in plastic cups and people stand around making awkward small talk until they're drunk enough to say what they really think about each other. Sharon, or Karen behind me, told Michael he was a prick at that party. I can't remember why, but that's probably why she's crying now. When someone dies, you start counting all the ways you failed them. The priest makes the sign of the cross over his chest. He closes his Bible and steps back. I walk slowly forward, bend down to grasp a handful of soil from the pile to one side, then toss it onto the closed casket. The wet clump of dirt makes an ugly hollow sound when it lands on the gray lid of the coffin, an uncaring splat of finality. Then it slides off, leaving a smear of brown behind like a shit stain. Abruptly, I'm shaking with anger. I taste ashes and bitterness in my mouth. What a stupid ritual this is. Why do we even bother? It's not like the dead can see us mourning them. They're gone. A sudden gust of cold wind rattles the leaves in the trees. I turn and walk away through the rain, not looking back when someone softly sobs my name. I need to be alone with my grief. I'm not one of those people who likes to commiserate over a tragedy, especially when the tragedy is my own. When I open the front door of the house, it takes a moment for me to register that I'm home. I have no recollection of the drive from the gravesite to here, though the blank spot in time doesn't surprise me. Since the accident, I've been in a fog. It's as if my brain is blanketed in thick clouds. I read somewhere that grief is more than an emotion. It's a physical experience, too. All kinds of nasty stress chemicals get released into the bloodstream when a person is grieving. Fatigue, nausea, headaches, dizziness, food aversion, insomnia. The list of side effects is long. I've got them all. I kick off my shoes and leave them under the console table in the foyer. Tossing my wool coat onto the back of a kitchen chair, I head to the fridge. I open the door and stand looking inside as rain drums against the window panes, and I try to convince myself I'm hungry. I'm not. I know I should eat to keep my strength up, but I have no appetite for anything. I let the door swing shut and press my fingers against my throbbing temples. Another headache. That's the fifth one this week. When I turn around, I notice the envelope on the table next to the fruit bowl. It sits by itself, a white rectangle with neat handwriting and a stamp that reads, "Love," in red letters. I know for a fact it wasn't there when I left. My first thought is that Fiona must have brought in the mail. Then I remember she cleans the house on Mondays. Today's Sunday. So how did it get there? As I cross to the table and pick up the letter, A rumble of thunder rattles the windows. A sudden gust of wind whistles through the trees outside. The eerie feeling intensifies when I read the return address. Washington State Penitentiary. Frowning, I tear open the edge of the envelope and pull out the single sheet of white unlined paper inside. I unfold it and read aloud.
I'll wait forever if I have to.
That's it. There's nothing else, except a signature scratched below the words. Dante. I flip the page over, but it's blank on the other side. For a fleeting moment, I think the letter must be intended for Michael. That idea gets tossed aside when I realize it's addressed to me. That's my name, right there on the front of the envelope, printed in neat block letters with blue pen. This Dante person, whoever he is, meant for me to receive this. But why? And what is he waiting for? Unsettled, I fold the letter into thirds, stuff it back into the envelope, and drop it on the table. Then I make sure all the doors and windows are locked. I draw the drapes and blinds against the wet gray afternoon, pour myself a glass of wine, then sit at the kitchen table, staring at the envelope with a strange feeling of foreboding. A feeling that something's coming, and that whatever it is, it isn't good. When I drag myself from bed in the morning, the headache is still with me, but the oppressive sense of dread is gone. It's gray and blustery outside, but the rain has stopped. For now, at least. It's wet and cloudy year-round in Washington, and January is especially dreary. I try to work, but give up only after an hour. I can't concentrate. Everything I draw looks depressed. The children's book I'm illustrating is about a shy boy who befriends a rabbit that can speak. But today, my rabbit looks like he'd rather take an overdose of Percocet than eat the carrots the boy tries to feed him. Abandoning my desk, I head to the kitchen. The first thing my gaze lands on is the letter on the table. The next thing I notice is the water all over the floor. Overnight, the ceiling has sprung a leak. Two of them, to be specific. I knew we should have bought something newer, but Michael didn't want a new home. He preferred older homes with character. When we moved into this Queen Anne Victorian 6 years ago, we were newlyweds with more energy than money. We spent weekends painting and hammering, pulling up old carpet and patching holes in drywall. It was fun for about 3 months. Then it became exhausting. Then it became a battle of wills. Us against a house that seemed determined to remain in a state of decay no matter how much we tried to update it. We'd replace a broken water pipe, then the heater would go out. We'd upgrade the ancient kitchen appliances, then we'd find toxic mold in the basement. It was a never-ending merry-go-round of repairs and replacements that drained our finances and our patience. Michael had planned to replace the leaky roof this year. I sometimes wonder what will be left on my to-do list when I die. But then I force myself to think about something else because I'm sad enough already. I bring two plastic buckets from the garage into the kitchen and place them on the floor under the places the ceiling is dripping, then get out the mop. It takes almost an hour to get all the water up and the floor dry. Just as I'm finishing, I hear the front door open and shut. I glance up at the clock on the microwave. 10 o'clock. Right on time. My housekeeper, Fiona, walks into the kitchen. She takes one look at me, drops the plastic bags of cleaning supplies she's holding, and lets out a blood-curdling scream. It's a testament to how exhausted I am that I don't even jump at the sound. Do I really look that bad? Remind me to put on some makeup before you come next week. Breathing hard, she braces an arm against the doorframe and makes the sign of the cross over her chest.
Christ on a cracker, you gave me a proper fright!
I frown at her. Who were you expecting? Santa Claus? Unlike the rest of Fiona, her laugh is small and weak. Of Scottish descent, she's plump and attractive, with bright blue eyes, rosy cheeks, and stout legs. Her hands are red and rough from years of work cleaning houses. Though somewhere north of 60, she's got the energy of a woman half her age. Having her help me keep the place up is an expensive luxury, but with two stories, over 5,000 square feet, and what seems like a million nooks and crannies that gather dust, the house needs constant cleaning. She shakes her head, fanning herself.
Oh, you got the old ticker pumping, my dear,
she chuckles.
It's been a while.
Then she turns serious and looks at me closely, peering at me as if she hasn't seen me in 100 years. How are you, Kayla? I glance away. I can't lie while gazing right into those piercing blue eyes. I'm okay, just trying to stay occupied. She hesitates as if unsure of what to say. Then she exhales in a gust and makes a helpless gesture toward the window and the cloudy view of the Puget Sound beyond.
I'm so sorry about what happened. I read about it in the paper. Such a shock. Is there anything I can do?
No, but thank you. I clear my throat. Don't cry. Don't cry. Pull yourself together. So don't bother with the kitchen today, obviously. I'll find someone to come out and take a look at the leak. But in the meantime, there's no sense cleaning up in here if it's only going to get wet all over again. My office doesn't need to get cleaned this week. And also, I swallow around the lump in my throat. Also, maybe skip Michael's office. I think I'd like to leave it as is for a while.
I understand, she says softly. So you'll be staying?
Yes, I'll be here all day.
No, I meant you'll be staying in the house.
There's something odd in her tone, a subtext I'm not getting, but then I understand. She's worried about her job security. Oh, I couldn't sell now. It's too soon to make such a major decision. Maybe in a year or two when things feel more settled. I don't know. Honestly, I'm just taking it one day at a time. She nods. We stand in awkward silence for a moment until she points over her shoulder.
I'll get to work now.
Okay. Thank you. She picks up the bags from where she dropped them on the floor, then turns to go. But she turns back suddenly and blurts,
I'll pray for you, dear.
I don't bother telling her not to waste her breath. I know I'm a lost cause, that no amount of prayer in the universe can help me. But that doesn't mean I have to be rude about it. I simply bite my lip, nod, and swallow my tears. When she walks out, my gaze lands on the letter on the table. I can't say what compels me to do it, but before I know it, I'm sitting down to write a reply. I scribble it on the back of the letter Dante sent me. What are you waiting for? I mail it before I lose my nerve. It takes a week before I get a response, and it's even shorter than mine. In fact, it's only one word.
You.
On the bottom right-hand corner of the paper, there's a smudge of something dried and rust-colored that looks like blood. 2. I put the letter in the back of my underwear drawer and leave it there, determined to forget about it. If another one comes, I might call the nice detective who interviewed me after the accident and see what he thinks about it. Maybe I'll get him to look into this Dante character and see what he can find out. In the meantime, I've got other things to worry about. Aside from the new roof leak, the house has also decided it has electrical problems. The dining room chandelier flickers. I hear popping and crackling noises when I hit the light switch in the master bedroom. Every once in a while, the doorbell rings when no one is there. I tried calling 3 different local roofers, but nobody called me back. So now I'm waiting for a handyman, some guy named Ed. I came across his business card in the bottom of my kitchen junk drawer when I was looking for a pen. I don't know why, but I'm expecting an older man with a balding head and a beer belly wearing a tool belt slung around his hips. Instead, what I get when I open the front door to his knock is a smiling, slender young man with long brown hair held off his face with a braided leather headband. He's wearing a John Lennon t-shirt, faded bell-bottom jeans and sandals, and holds a rusty metal toolbox in one hand. He reeks of pot.
Hey, you Kayla?
That's me. Grinning, he extends his hand.
I'm Eddie.
I return his smile and we shake hands. He seems sweet and harmless. 2 things I appreciate in any man I allow into my home while I'm here alone. Come in, I'll show you around. He follows me into the kitchen, commenting on how cool he thinks the house is. Cool, but falling apart a little more every day. I gesture to the 2 brown water-stained rings on the kitchen ceiling.
Yeah, these little houses need lots of TLC.
He cranes his neck to stare up at the stains.
Especially with the humidity here. You got mold problems?
Not anymore. Took care of that a few years back. Right now it's the roof leak and the electrical. I give him an overview of what's been happening with the lights and the doorbell. Plus, I smell something burning when I run the dryer. And the TV sometimes turns itself off. Oh, and a couple of light bulbs have exploded recently. A sudden cold draft lifts the hairs on my arms and the back of my neck and sends a tingle down my spine. Shivering, I rub the hands over the goosebumps on my arms. I should ask him to have a look at the weather stripping around the windows while he's here, but first things first. Let me show you where the electrical panel is. Eddie follows me to the utility room at the back of the house next to the garage. The washer and dryer are there, along with the cabinets containing a hodgepodge of household supplies. Setting his toolbox on the floor, Eddie flips open the metal door on the electrical panel and does a quick visual scan of the switches.
I'll check the voltage first, see if the breaker's running at the right capacity. Then I'll look at the integrity of the wiring. You might have water damage or fraying that could cause problems. Then I'll check all your outlets, make sure they're not compromised. Where's the meter?
Right outside the garage door. He nods.
Dig it. I'll take a look at that too. Should take me an hour or so to get through everything. Then I'll give you an estimate for the repairs. Sound good?
Sounds great, thanks. To get into the attic, the access is on the second floor through the master bedroom closet. The ladder's in the garage.
Cool.
Holler if you need me, I'll be around.
Will do.
I leave him to it and head into my office. I'm able to work for a while before the headache starts. It's a dull throbbing around my temples and pressure behind my eyes so strong it makes them water. I lie on the small sofa with the shades drawn and the lights off until Eddie appears in the doorway with his toolbox.
Oh, sorry, man. Didn't know you were sleeping. I was just gonna check the outlets in here.
Disoriented, I sit up. I wasn't asleep, just resting my eyes. I have a terrible headache. He nods in sympathy.
I used to get crazy migraines.
Used to, past tense. I feel a weird pang of hope. Did you find something that helped them? Nothing I take makes a dent.
You'll laugh. Mind if I turn the lights on?
Go ahead, and I won't laugh, I promise. I'm too desperate. When Eddie hits the switch and light floods the room, I wince. I try to stand, but discover I'm too dizzy. So I sink back onto the sofa, close my eyes, and gingerly pinch the bridge of my nose. When did I last eat? I can't remember. Eddie ambles around, hunting for outlets. He's so slim, his footsteps are silent on the floor. I've known cats who made more noise.
After I started seeing a therapist, the headaches went away. Poof, man, just gone. Turns out I had lots of emotions bottled up.
I open my eyes to find him crouched under my desk with a small power meter in his hand. He sinks it into the electrical outlet, waits a moment as he reads whatever it's telling him, then stands and moves to the next outlet where he repeats the process.
Psychosomatic illness, they call it. Your brain literally makes you sick. Stress is that toxic. Far out, isn't it?
Far out, I agree, wondering if he lives in a commune or co-op. They're all over Washington and the Seattle area. Communal living groups started in the free love 60s, where people share housing and resources and eschew modern things like cell phones and GMO foods. I'm much too private to live in such close quarters with people I'm not having sex with, but I don't judge anybody's life choices. Standing, he turns to look at me.
I can give you my doc's name if you want. Unless you don't think stress could be a problem for you.
Does losing my husband count as stress? I don't know why I said that, or why I said it in the biting way I did. I don't normally wear my heart on my sleeve, and I'm not sarcastic like Michael was. He dealt with depressing or morbid things with black humor that sometimes came off as insensitivity, but I knew was just a coping mechanism. The man was a marshmallow. Confused, Eddie stares at me.
You've lost him?
No one could possibly be this dumb. He died. Now he looks stricken.
Oh, dude, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Was it recent?
New Year's Eve.
Holy shit, that's only a couple weeks ago.
I should stop talking now. Every word out of my mouth makes poor Eddie more and more upset. I've always had a problem over-empathizing with other people, which is one of the reasons I tend to keep to myself. Everyone else's emotions piled on top of my own can get suffocating sometimes. Yes, anyway, I manage to stand this time, then avoid Eddie's eyes as I say, so, what's the verdict? In his pause, I feel him looking me over, reading the stiffness in my body and the artificially bright tone of my voice. Maybe he's empathetic too, because he takes pity on me and changes the subject.
Well, that leak in the roof is a bummer. It's coming from the roof deck by the turret, which means you're gonna have to remove the shingles and cut away the wood to repair the leak. Between the gables, the turret, and the steep pitch of the roof itself, it's gonna be a major job, I'm sorry to say. You're definitely gonna have to bring in a specialist.
My heart sinks. Anytime a specialist gets involved, the price goes up. I tried calling 3 different roofers before I found you, but couldn't get hold of anybody. He chuckles, shaking his head.
Yeah, I don't know why, but roofer guys are notoriously flaky. I'd give you a recommendation, but I don't know anybody I trust with a job like this.
Okay, thanks anyway. I'll just keep trying. I was hoping to avoid calling a firm from Seattle because they're so pricey, but I guess I have to. After a beat, he says gently,
If you want, I can look at the quote you get. You know, so you don't get ripped off.
Because I'm alone, he means. Because I won't have a man around to negotiate for me. Because someone in my position, grieving, disoriented, desperate, is a target for scams. When he smiles, I know he's not trying to flirt with me. He's just a genuinely nice guy trying to help someone out who he can tell is in distress. If only the whole world were made up of such kind people. It's very sweet of you, Eddie, but I can handle it. I come from a long line of ball-busting Jersey girls. His smile turns into a laugh. He has a crooked front tooth, which is oddly endearing.
I knew one of those once. She was only 4'10", but she scared the living shit out of me.
I smile at him. Even small dragons can still breathe fire.
True that.
So how about the electrical? It's bad, isn't it? He shrugs.
No, everything checked out.
I stare at him in disbelief. What do you mean it checked out?
I mean there aren't any problems. The current's strong, breakers aren't tripping, can't find any frays in the wiring, there's no arc faults, hot spots, dead outlets, or loose connections.
He shrugs again.
Everything looks groovy.
That can't be right. What about the flickering lights?
Could be a problem with the local power grid. You might want to ask a neighbor if they've got the same thing happening. Parts of the network around here are over a century old. Whatever the cause, it's not coming from inside the house.
And the exploding light bulbs? That's definitely not normal.
It's more common than you think. Either the manufacturer didn't put enough insulation in the base, so the filament overheated, or there was a loose connection between the bulb and the socket that made the current jump. Just make sure you don't buy cheap bulbs from now on, and also make sure they're screwed in real tight.
I'm getting a little exasperated. Did he even check the wiring, or was he up in the attic smoking pot this whole time? Okay, but the doorbell rings when nobody's there. And what about the burning smell when I run the dryer? How do you explain that? He hesitates. I sense him carefully choosing his words.
I mean, you have been under a lot of stress lately, man.
He adds sheepishly.
What with your husband and all?
For a moment, I don't understand. Then I get it, and I have to take a breath before I speak so I don't bite off his head. My mind isn't playing tricks on me, Eddie. I'm not hallucinating electrical problems. Uncomfortable under my stare, he shifts his weight from foot to foot.
I'm not trying to be disrespectful. All I can tell you is that when I was in a bad place, I thought I heard whispering voices and saw shadows move.
Did any of that happen while you were under the influence of mind-altering substances? His expression is pained, which I take as a yes. Either way, I think our business relationship has reached its conclusion. Maybe whoever I get to do the roof can recommend an electrician who's sober. Never mind, thanks for coming out to check. What do I owe you? He stuffs the small power meter into the back pocket of his jeans, bends to pick up his toolbox from where he left in the floor, then straightens and shakes his head.
Nothing.
No, that's not right. You should be compensated for your time. His smile is lopsided. He flips his long hair over his shoulder.
I appreciate it, but it's my policy that if I don't find a problem, the visit is free.
I have a sneaking suspicion he just made up that policy on the spot because he feels sorry for me. Are you sure? I don't want to take advantage.
Nah, we're cool. But maybe if one of your friends needs a handyman?
I'll recommend you, you bet. Thanks, Eddie. I really appreciate it. He grins at me, flashing that crooked tooth.
I'm out of here then. You take care now, okay? And call me if you want my doc's name. He's really the best.
I force a smile and lie. I will. Thanks again.
I'll let myself out. See you around.
He leaves. When I hear the front door open and close, I go after him to make sure it's locked. Then I go into the kitchen for a glass of water, but stop short when I see the envelope sitting on the table. Even from halfway across the room, I can see the love stamp in the corner and the neat block printing in blue pen spelling out my name. My breath catches in my throat. My heart starts pounding. My steady hands begin to tremble. Then all the overhead lights in the kitchen ceiling grow brighter. With a sharp buzz of noise, they flicker and go out.
3. Dear Kayla, you didn't respond to my last letter, which I understand, because you think we've never met. You're wrong. I could bore you with the details, but for now, just trust that I know you. In every way one person can know another, I know you. I know the sight, sound, taste, and smell of you. I know your darkest darks and your lightest lights. I know your dreams, your nightmares, and every secret you've ever kept hidden. All those nameless desires you never admitted even to yourself. I know the shape of your soul. I know your hands tremble as you read these words, and your heart beats as fast as a hummingbird's wings. I know you want to tear this letter up, and I also know you won't. How I need to touch you. How I need to hear your voice. I can't, of course, because I'm here and you're there. But the distance doesn't make the longing go away. I can still taste your skin. Dante.
4. I stand next to the kitchen window with the letter in my hands and read it again in the gray afternoon light. Then again. Then once more. Because it's so bizarre, my brain refuses to come up with any plausible explanations for it. Probably because there aren't any. The overhead lights flicker back on, illuminating the room. Throwing my arms in the air, I say to the ceiling, I wish you'd done that when Mr. Everything's Great Eddie was here. Then I fold the letter, put it back into its envelope, set it on the table, and pour myself a glass of red wine. I gulp it down, deciding on impulse that I need to make sure the house is secure. I go from room to room, checking window latches and door locks until I'm satisfied that I'm locked in tight. After that's done, I sit down at the kitchen table and make a list. I always think best with a pen in my hand. Possible explanations. Someone is fucking with you. I immediately cross that out because obviously someone is fucking with me. The question is why, and why now? This Dante person saw the article in the newspaper about the accident. He smells money. He's trying to pull a lonely widow scam. As soon as I write that down, I think I've nailed it. He's in prison after all. To get there, he had to do something bad. So the man has what could be politely called compromised morals. He probably trolls the obituary section of the newspapers and sends these letters out to new widows all over the place, hoping one of them will take the bait and write him back so he can strike up a relationship and seduce her into sending him large sums of cash. But the letter is too weird to be scam bait, and too specific. He should have just said he was a lonely guy looking for a pen pal, not that he could still taste my skin, or that he knows the shape of my soul. What does that even mean, anyway? What does any of it mean? Nothing, I mutter, glaring at the envelope. It's a fraud. I specifically don't address the mystery of how a letter arrived on my kitchen table without me knowing how it got there, again, because I suspect I'm having more lapses in memory and brought it in from the mailbox myself. I take a little consolation in the fact that the letter from the mysterious Dante has no overtones of hostility. Admittedly creepy, with all the I know you business, at least he isn't threatening me harm. Though I suppose he wouldn't be able to. I think I read somewhere that prison correspondence is monitored. He'd probably get in trouble if he tried to send a violent threat through the mail. Not that he'd have a reason to send a threat. Michael didn't have any enemies, and neither do I. We're your average middle-class married couple, both overworked and overtired, so our idea of fun is snuggling together on the sofa to watch a movie on Friday nights. Was our idea of fun was watching a movie together. We'll never do that again. A sudden tightness in my chest makes it impossible to breathe. Dizzy, I rest my head on my forearms and listen to the rain tapping against the windows like 1,000 fingernails. He's just a jerk felon who's trying to prey on a vulnerable woman, I tell the tabletop. It doesn't make me feel any better. In fact, it makes me feel worse. Who does this guy think he is sending me this crap? Whoever he is, he clearly has mental problems. I sit up abruptly. Maybe that's it. Maybe he's not trying to run a scam on me at all. Maybe the mysterious Dante is simply out of his mind. I'm not sure which I feel more, empathy or trepidation. I mean, if the poor guy is only locked up because he's got some kind of mental illness that wasn't diagnosed and he should really be medicated, not incarcerated, that's one thing. On the other hand, he did something to land himself in prison. What if it was something violent? He could be dangerous. I remove the letter from the envelope and read it again. An odd impulse makes me lift it to my nose and sniff. A faint whiff of cedar and wood smoke fills my nostrils, and something else, earthy and musky, like the scent of a man or an animal. The thought unsettles me. I fold the letter quickly and slide it back into the envelope and take it upstairs to my bedroom and stuff it in the back of my underwear drawer. Then I go back downstairs, log on to my computer, and do a search for Seattle roofers. When the doorbell rings 2 days later, I'm in the laundry room folding towels. I head to the front door, hoping an actual person will be there this time when I open it. There is. And he's everything sweet, smiling Eddie is not. His height and size are immediately intimidating, as is his stony expression. He has dark hair, dark eyes, and a dark beard covering a square jaw. Wearing faded jeans, battered work boots, and a hunter green button-down shirt rolled up muscular tattooed forearms, he looks like he just wandered out of the forest after building himself a cabin from trees he cut down with an axe. To my great surprise, I find him sexy. It's surprising because he's not my type at all. I like the clean-cut Wall Street type, a man with an advanced degree or two, excellent hygiene, and a solid understanding of how 401k works. This guy looks like the founder of an underground fight club. He stands in the doorway, gazing at me in intense silence until I say, "Can I help you?"
"Aiden."
When it becomes apparent that's all he's going to say, I assume he's looking for someone named Aiden, who he thinks lives in this house. "I'm sorry, there's no Aiden here." His stony expression flickers with what appears to be contempt.
"I'm Aiden, from Seattle Roofing."
He jerks his thumb over his shoulder, indicating the white pickup in the driveway with the company name stenciled on the side in red letters. Embarrassed, I laugh. "Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you weren't coming until next week."
"Had an opening in the schedule,"
he says without a trace of warmth.
"Thought I'd drop by. If this is a bad time."
No, this is great," I interrupt, swinging the door open wider. "Please, come in." He steps across the threshold. Instantly, the foyer feels smaller. I shut the door behind him and gesture toward the kitchen. "I'll show you where the leaks are if you want to start there," he answers with a wordless nod. I feel as if a rabid wolf is following behind me as we make our way into the kitchen. No, not a wolf. Something bigger and even more dangerous. A gorilla, maybe. Or a lion. "So that's where the water's coming in," I say, pointing to the kitchen ceiling. I had a handyman out to look at the electrical. He also looked at the roof and said something about the deck needing to be cut out and replaced near the turret. Aiden didn't look at the ceiling. His cool, steady gaze remains fixed on me.
"You get the electrical fixed?"
"No, not really."
"Which is it? No or not really?"
He doesn't smile when he says it. There's no hint of playfulness in his tone or expression. He isn't hostile exactly. It's just that I'm getting the impression he'd rather be anywhere else on Earth than here. I take a moment to answer, because I'm not sure if I even want to have this guy in my house. I'm finding him more and more irritating with every passing second. The handyman said he couldn't find any problems with the wiring, but I'm still having issues. Aiden grunts.
"I'll take a look at it."
"You do electrical too?" His dark eyes meet mine.
"I do everything."
He says it flatly, as if I've deeply insulted his manhood. as if he can't believe that I couldn't tell just by looking at him that he's Captain Capable. I wish someone else were here so I could turn and ask a reasonable person what they think Aiden's problem is, but since I'm alone, I'll have to figure it out by myself. Do you do impressions of a person who knows how to be polite? That might come in handy from time to time. Like, right now, for instance. His brows draw down over his eyes.
You want your house fixed, or you want to have a tea party, lady?
His rude tone makes my hackles go up. I don't have tea parties with wild animals, and yes, I'd like my house fixed, but I don't pay people to be mean to me. Also, my name is Kayla. In case you haven't noticed, women are actual individuals. So are you going to act like a human being now, or are you leaving? He bites back whatever insult he's got brewing and glowers at me. Then he looks up at the stains on the ceiling and exhales a slow breath.
Sorry,
he says, his voice gruff.
It's been a bad couple of weeks.
When he swallows and a muscle in his jaw clenches, I feel like a jerk. It's easy to forget that everybody else has problems when you're so caught up in your own. I say softly, yeah, I get that. He glances at me, warily, as if he's not sure if I'm about to give him a smack or not, which makes me feel worse. Listen, let's start over. I stick out my hand. Hi, I'm Kayla Reese. He looks at my hand. Something approximating a smile lifts the corners of his mouth, but disappears before it commits to staying. He takes my hand and shakes it solemnly.
Nice to meet you, Kayla. Aiden Lee Wright.
His hand is huge, rough, and warm, like the rest of him, except for the warm part. I smile and drop his hand. Okay, now, that's all out of the way. Will you please help me with my roof? I'm desperate. He tilts his head and considers me.
You always get over stuff so quickly?
An image of Michael's casket being slowly lowered into the ground flashes through my mind. My smile dies. A lump forms in my throat. I say tightly, no. Aiden's gaze sharpens. I can't stand to meet his piercing stare. Suddenly, I just need to be alone. I can already feel the hot prick of tears welling in my eyes. Backing up a step, I cross my arms over my chest and say, the roof access is in the master bedroom closet, upstairs, first door on the right. I'll let you take a look around. Please excuse me. I turn and leave him standing in the middle of my kitchen. I barely make it into my office and get the door closed behind me before I burst into tears. 5. Dear Dante, I don't have any money, so go pick on someone else if that's what you're after. Seriously, I'm broke. Who are you? What do you want? Why did you contact me? You said you know me, but you're wrong. I don't know anyone with your name, much less anyone in prison. I'm not judging you, so you know. But I'd like to know what you did to get yourself there. Actually, forget it. I'm only writing now to ask you to stop contacting me. If you send another letter, I'll give it to my detective friend and let him deal with you. Sincerely, Kayla. 6. I take a while to pull myself together, splash water from the bathroom faucet on my face, and dry my eyes. Then I put a stamp on the envelope, slide the letter inside and seal it, and take it out to the mailbox. When I return to the kitchen, Aiden is nowhere in sight. I go into the laundry room and finish folding the towels, go back to the kitchen and empty the plastic buckets into the sink, replace them on the floor under the drips, then stare into the fridge in search of something I know I won't eat because I have no appetite. Along with everything else, it died with my husband. I shut the door, rest my forehead against it, close my eyes, and sigh. That's how Aiden finds me.
You okay?
I look over to find him standing in the kitchen doorway, gazing at me with what might be concern or alarm. I can't tell. Honestly, I haven't been less okay and probably never. I frown. Was that a double negative? Aiden says.
Doesn't matter. I got it. You're not good.
If he's anything like most men I've known, he'd rather chew his own arm off than hear the details, so I change the subject. I'll be better if you tell me you can fix my roof.
I can fix your roof.
Oh, really? His expression sours. I've insulted his manhood again. Sorry, it's just that I haven't had any good news lately, so I'm happy to hear that. He examines my expression.
You don't look happy.
I'm not. It was a figure of speech. We stare at each other in silence until he says,
You're gonna be less happy when I tell you how much it'll cost.
Should I be sitting down for this?
Dunno. Are you prone to fainting?
I lift my brows. I'd ask if you were making a joke, but I'm pretty sure humor isn't in your wheelhouse.
You don't know me. I could be hilarious.
We gaze at each other. Neither one of us smiles. That skull tattoo on his neck looks as if it's smirking at me. I ask, Are you hilarious? Without missing a beat, he says,
No.
I can't help it. I laugh. Great. So I'm not happy and you're not funny. This project should go extremely well.
Except I just made you laugh. So maybe I am funny and you are happy.
When I only stare at him, he says,
You were for a second anyway.
Is this weird? I can't tell if this is weird or not. Feeling awkward and self-conscious, I clear my throat. Well, thanks for that.
No problem. You're looking at 10,000.
That's such a sharp right turn, it takes my poor brain a moment to figure out that he's talking about the price I'll charge to repair the roof. 10,000?
Yeah.
Dollars?
No, seashells. Of course, dollars.
I make a face at him. And you claim you're not hilarious.
I'll write up the quote.
Without another word, he turns around and walks out of the house. I have no idea if he's leaving and will mail me the quote or what, but he comes right back in without knocking and sits down at my kitchen table with a pad of paper. He starts scribbling on it. He's so big, he makes the table and chairs look like they belong in a kindergarten class. When he rips the piece of paper off the pad and holds it out to me, I take it and look it over. Labor is 8,000, but materials are only 2? He leans back in the chair and folds his arm over his chest.
If you want, I'll bring all the materials over and you can do it yourself.
Smartass. What I want is a fair price.
That is a fair price.
How can your labor possibly be so much?
Are you an expert in construction pricing?
No, but I am an expert in BS spotting. I flick my wrist, snapping the paper. And this is BS. He glances at my wedding ring.
Ask your husband if you don't believe me. It's a fair quote.
A flush of heat creeps up my neck. My heart starts banging around in my chest. Holding his gaze, I say stiffly, I'm perfectly capable of making judgments on my own. His eyes narrow, but not like he's angry, just like he's trying to figure me out. Then the kitchen lights flicker, reminding me that this boorish beast is the only person who called me back besides Eddie the pot-loving hippie, so maybe I shouldn't throw him out of my kitchen just yet. I pull up a chair and sit across from him. I don't have $10,000. He says nothing. He simply stares at me. Oh, how I'd like to take his quote and give him paper cuts with it all up and down his arms. Not that you'd be able to see the cuts through all the tattoos, but still, it would be satisfying. I'm not lying to you, Mr. Lee Wright. I don't have $10,000.
It's Aiden. And how are you living in a house this size if you don't have any money?
That's a very personal question that I'm not going to answer. And I never said I didn't have any money. I said I don't have $10,000. He leans over, rests those big tattooed forearms on the table, and threads his fingers together.
So we're negotiating.
His intensity is formidable, but I don't want him to think he's intimidating me. I sit up straighter in the chair and lift my chin. You say that like negotiating is your favorite thing.
It is.
I would have guessed charming potential clients with your dazzling sense of humor.
No, that's my second favorite thing.
We're staring at each other again. Once again, neither of us is smiling. Finally, I say, 4,000. His snort indicates what he thinks of my opening bid. It's double your materials cost.
I'm able to do basic math. Thank you. 10,000.
I thought we were negotiating.
We are.
Then you can't just keep saying the same number.
Says who?
Says me.
Lucky for me, you're not the one with the upper hand here.
I stare at him in outrage with my mouth hanging open. Then a strange thing happens. He smiles.
I just wanted to see what you'd do when I said that.
I'd like to run him over with my car. I say firmly, 4,500.
$99.99.
You've got to be kidding me.
We've already established I don't have a sense of humor.
If you're going to come down by $1 every time we go back and forth, we'll be here until next year. His gaze is level and his voice is cool.
You got somewhere else to be, Kayla.
Is he screwing with me? What exactly is going on? Another rumble of thunder makes the kitchen windows shiver in their frames. The rain starts to fall harder, pattering against the roof. The drips falling into the buckets on the floor pick up speed, little plop, plop, plops that seem to mock me, like Mr. Personality here is. I can't afford $10,000 to fix my roof, or $99.99 either, so thank you for your time. I leave the quote on the table, stand, and gaze down my nose at him. I appreciate you coming out. He looks up at me. His dark eyes are calculating.
What if I throw in the electrical?
That's generous, but it won't make money magically appear in my bank account. Nice to meet you. I'll show you out. I walk away, expecting him to rise and follow me. When he doesn't, I stop and turn around. He's still sitting there at my kitchen table. He isn't even looking at me. He's just watching the water drip into the buckets on the floor. Mr. Leewright, without turning his head, he says,
It's Aiden, and if you can afford $5,000, I know a guy who can help you out.
I think about that. Is he licensed? He makes a small motion of his head, a shake that seems to indicate his amazement at my stupidity. I say crossly, I'm not letting anybody work on my property who isn't licensed and insured. I'm sure I don't have to go over all the reasons why. His shoulders rise and fall as he inhales and exhales. He runs a hand through his thick, dark hair. Then he shakes his head again and rises. He walks to where I'm standing and gazes down at me.
It's me. I'm the guy. I'll be back first thing in the morning. Cash or check. I don't take credit cards.
Then he brushes past me and leaves without asking if we have a deal. He already knows we have a deal because I'm desperate. Son of a bitch just checkmated me. 7. At 8 o'clock sharp the next morning, Mr. Personality knocks on my door. Pounds on it, actually, with brutal force. As if he's the leader of a SWAT team and he's been tasked with taking down a group of crazed hostage takers to save 100 people's lives. I open the door and stare at him. Good morning, Mr. Leewright. What's the emergency? Frowning, he looks me up and down. Because the house is freezing, I'm wearing a bulky sweater with a down vest over it along with sweatpants and a scarf. But the man looks at me like I'm wearing a beehive on top of my head paired with assless leather chaps. He asks,
You okay?
Do I look as if I'm not okay? No, don't answer that. Why were you trying to break down my door?
I've been standing out here for 10 minutes.
I see your sense of time is as good as your sense of humor. He holds up his arm. Wrapped around his thick wrist is a chunky black watch. Some kind of sports thing that tracks your steps and spies on you while you sleep. He taps the crystal. The readout shows 8:10.
10 minutes. And for the fourth time, it's Aiden.
Didn't I just look at the clock in my kitchen? It said 8 on the nose. Flustered, I say, Sorry, my clocks must be off.
Is your hearing off too?
Because it seems to be our thing, we stand there and stare at each other in silence. Until he demands,
Look, are you letting me in or not?
I haven't decided yet.
Well, decide. I'm not getting any younger.
How old is he? 30? 35? Hard to tell. He's in great shape, whatever his age. God, those biceps are huge. And those thighs could crush a Volkswagen. Yes, come in, I say too loudly, trying to drown out the idiotic voice in my head simpering over his big, stupid muscles. Avoiding his eyes, I leave the door open and turn and walk into the kitchen. I sit down at the table, then stand up again because I don't know what to do with myself. The front door closes. Heavy footsteps cross through the foyer. He lumbers into the kitchen and stands a few feet away from me. We commence our silent staring game of who will say something strange first. I break under the strain before he does. I have your money. He looks at my empty hands.
Do I have to dig around in your backyard for it? Or are you going to give it to me?
You know, I think you lied when you said you don't have a sense of humor. I think you're a big frickin' comedian.
You can curse in front of me if you want. I won't get offended.
I take a moment to massage my pounding forehead before sighing. That's very generous. Thank you. I was up all night worrying about how not to upset your delicacy.
You're welcome. And for the record, My delicacy is as solid as my humor.
Either he's trying not to smile, or he's having painful stomach cramps. It's hard to tell. The man has a face like a brick wall. You said a check was okay, right? He inclines his head. Today, he's wearing another version of lumberjack chic with an untucked, faded black and red plaid flannel to go along with the faded jeans. His boots are... Oh, no. Following my gaze, he looks down at his feet.
What?
You tracked mud all over my floor. He glances back up at me.
You don't have a doormat. It's raining outside.
You make a good point.
Plus, this floor is pretty dirty anyway.
Excuse me, but I just mopped it.
When? 100 years ago.
My neck starts to burn with anger. Man, this guy gets under my skin. Glaring at him, I say flatly, Yes, Mr. Leewright, 100 years ago. I'm going to get my checkbook. Do I make the check to Godzilla, or should I just leave it blank?
Godzilla's fine,
he replies, gazing steadily at me.
What should I put on your receipt? Dragon lady with the sad eyes?
I can't argue with the first thing, but the second one annoys me. I don't have sad eyes. He takes a beat to consider me before saying,
It's none of my business, but if you need some help...
I don't need any help, I interrupt hotly. I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me.
Didn't say there was.
Aiden replies softly, but his gaze isn't as tranquil as his voice. His eyes are like his fist pounding on my front door, loudly demanding an answer. With my heart racing, I say, You know what? I don't think this is going to work. I'm sorry to inconvenience you, but I'm going to ask you to leave now. Rain thrums against the roof. A gust of wind rattles the windows. Somewhere upstairs, a loose shutter bangs back and forth, rusty hinges groaning. After a long, tense moment, Aiden says,
Okay.
He turns and walks to the front door. I'm relieved until he turns back and gazes at me. His eyes are dark and penetrating. It feels as if they can see straight down to the bottom of my soul.
But if you change your mind, Kayla, you've got my number.
I don't know if he means changing my mind about needing help with my roof or something else. He walks out, closing the front door behind him. As soon as he's gone, I pull the scarf from around my burning neck and go to the powder room down the hall. I switch on the light and stand in front of the mirror and look at myself, trying to determine what's so wrong with my eyes. I gasp in shock when I see the ugly purple splotches encircling my neck. The one just beneath my left earlobe looks like it was made by a thumb. 5 days later, the marks on my neck have completely faded. I searched the internet for causes of unexplained bruising and found everything from diabetes to vitamin deficiencies. Considering my poor diet and the amount of stress I've been under lately, I'm betting it has to do with that. I'm probably anemic, which could also explain the fatigue. The marks could also have been caused by the accident. But I don't want to think about that, because thinking about it would mean remembering it, reliving it, and I'm not prepared for that yet. I doubt I'll ever be. I've put that horrible day into a box and put the box up on a high shelf in the back of my mind for safekeeping. But knowing as I do that my mental health is fragile, I decide to attend a local grief group. The meeting is held in a room at the senior center. A dozen or so folding metal chairs are arranged in a circle in the middle of an expanse of ugly brown carpeting. Against one wall, a rickety wood table is dressed with a white plastic cloth and set up with coffee and tea service, and a tilting stack of styrofoam cups. Posters of smiling seniors are tacked around with reminders to get your annual flu shots. The lone window looks out over the parking lot and the rainy evening beyond. A few people are already sitting down when I arrive. I can tell by the way they're chatting that they all know each other. Feeling anxious, I head over to the table with the coffee and pour myself a cup. As I'm debating whether or not I'll stay or run out the door and make a quick escape, a woman walks up beside me and reaches out for a styrofoam cup.
First time? She asks, pouring herself a coffee.
Yes. You?
Oh, no, I've been coming to this group for 6 years now.
She turns to me, smiling. She's brunette, 40-ish, and chic, wearing heels, an ivory Chanel suit, and a huge diamond ring on her finger. Her skin is flawless. Her haircut costs more than my entire outfit. She's incredibly pretty. I feel like a clod of dirt standing next to a unicorn. She says,
You don't have to participate if you don't want to.
There's no pressure to join in. You're welcome to simply sit and listen. Well, that's what I do. Sometimes just being around other people who understand what you're going through is enough. Jan's the group leader. She gestures to a lanky, gray-haired woman in a flowing paisley dress who's walking through the door. Jan greets the group and takes a chair, dropping her bulky purse onto the floor. I'm Madison, the woman beside me adds. Hi, Madison. I'm Kayla. Nice to meet you. I want to ask why she's here, but don't. I don't know the rules yet, and I don't want to offend someone being so nice who can probably tell I'm panicking. As if she can read my mind, she says, my daughter was kidnapped when she was 4 years old. The police never found her. I almost drop my coffee. Instead, I cover my mouth with my hand and whisper, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Madison takes a sip from her cup and stares down into it as if searching for something. It was my fault. I let go of her hand while we were shopping at the mall, just for a second, to check a text from my husband, but when I looked up, she was gone. She lifts her head and meets my eyes. Her own are haunted. That's the worst thing, and it was my own fault. That, and not knowing if she's still alive. The FBI said if a missing child isn't found within 24 hours, they most likely never will be. They gave up on the search after 6 months because there were no leads. It's as if Olivia disappeared into thin air. And every day since, I wonder what happened to my baby. Who took her? What they might have done to her? Madison's eyes glaze over as if she's gazing at something far away. Her voice drops. Olivia would be 10 years old now. I can't tell you how many hours I've spent searching child pornography sites on the dark web looking for her. The only thing keeping me from killing myself is the hope that one day I'll see a girl in one of those awful videos with one blue eye and one brown, and I'll get to hold her again. I think I might throw up. My hands shake so badly, the coffee in the cup sloshes around, almost spilling over the rim. Madison turns her haunted gaze to me. Her sophisticated veneer has dropped. She seems to have aged 10 years in a few minutes, leaving her looking like exactly what she is, a woman living in hell. Tears welling in her eyes, she says hoarsely, do you think she could forgive me? I want to burst out sobbing, but I rest my shaking hand on her forearm and say, there's nothing to forgive. The person who took her is evil. It wasn't your fault. She smiles sadly. That's what my therapist says, but I don't believe it. Neither did my husband. He left me for someone else, someone much younger. I just heard they're having twins. A voice calls out, if everyone would like to sit down, we can get started. Stunned and sick to my stomach, I glance over at the group. Jan is waving to two people just coming through the door. When I turn back to Madison, she's already pulling away. I grip her arm and say desperately, has it helped you, this group? She looks at me for a brief moment before saying softly, what do you think? Then she turns and walks away. She takes a seat at the circle and looks down at her coffee. No one greets her. She doesn't acknowledge anyone else either. It's as if she's in her own little bubble of pain, cut off from everything else. I picture myself 6 years from now telling a stranger at this very coffee table about what happened to my husband and having her ask me if the group has helped. And know without a shadow of a doubt that my answer would be the same as Madison's. A big, fat, fucking no. I set my cup down on the table and walk out without looking back. Across the street from the senior center is a bar called Cole's. Its yellow neon sign glows like a beacon. Ignoring the rain and not bothering with the crosswalk, I run straight across the boulevard and plow through Cole's heavy wooden front door. The moment I step inside, I spot Aiden Leewright sitting in a booth in the corner.
8. He notices me right away. He was about to take a drink, but freezes with his glass of beer halfway to his mouth. It's too late to pretend I didn't see him, so I send him a curt nod and walk over.